You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Hunter Moss just asked me if I have a gong to start this, another edition of MMA for the Mind. And I don't know, and I love mixed mental artists.
Yeah, well, that's what you're becoming, Brian. I mean, you know, you're going to be all the threats, not just a triple threat, but thousands of them.
The problem is when I try to change, you know, when I get into an argument or I start to try to kind of pontificate on an idea, I'm not very detail-oriented, mm-hmm. So I'll drop some details and people are like, you're a fucking asshole.
Yeah. But see, here's the key thing, right? So we were talking about this before, the difference between being an intuitionist and a rationalist, right?
Yeah, this was the conversation that Jonathan Haidt and Sam Harris had.
Right, on
their
podcast.
Where Jonathan Haidt said, the difference between you and I is that you are you are a rationalist.
Yeah.
I am an intuitionist. The meaning and implying that the mental model that people like Sam Harris are working on is inherently flawed because it's not taking into account the new brain science that suggests that human beings are very, very emotional and make decisions, so-called rational decisions, based on their emotions.
Yes, and that includes Sam Harris, because Sam Harris is a human being.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is you have to understand that this science is from the 1970s. Oh. It's that old.
Yeah.
But it's still in the same way that we talked about how the Diffusion of Innovations was written in 1962, but that still, you know, someone like David Sloan Wilson hasn't even read the book.
Yeah.
Right?
I gotta read that book.
Well, you kind of do and you kind of don't. Like, so the interesting thing is that, you know, David Sloan Wilson is talking about solving the science to narrative chain problem, right? So basically,
trying to get scientific ideas dumbed down enough, or at least user friendly enough to get into the layman's mind,
the decision maker's mind. But fundamentally, it's two. So if you look at, let's look back to where science was, you know, nearly 300 years ago, 250 years ago, right, with someone like Ben Franklin, right? Yeah. So Ben Franklin was a scientist. No scientist is really going to deny that. Officially, he was a natural philosopher because they didn't really, like, mm-hmm. talk about scientists yet. But at the same time,
Newton was considered a natural philosopher. Yeah.
Same thing. So they didn't really have the terminology, but certainly Ben Franklin was an experimentalist. He tried things out, and he figured out lots and lots of interesting things about the natural world. He also was an inventor. So, you know, he had this fairly sort of broad range of interests. But one of the things that Ben Franklin loved to do was collect anecdotes. He loved a great story, and he would tell this. And if you read Ben Franklin's autobiography, it still reads very well. It's still a great, great book.
Mm. And there's that famous quote where he came out after they came up with essentially the Constitution, after they wrote the Constitution or the Federalist Papers, and before it had the Bill of Rights, but whatever. She said, "What did you do in there?" He said, "We created a republic, madam, if you can keep it."
Yeah. And he's hilarious, right? He was a satirist, he was a wit, he was all this sort of stuff. But so when you read these books by these intuitionists, people like Daniel Kahneman and Jonathan Haidt and all of that sort of stuff, when they are trying to explain this stuff, right, they don't generally talk about the scientific experiments, which we can make good stories. They generally tell a story from Ben Franklin's autobiography. Mm. And the story is that Ben Franklin was on a ship from Boston to England, and while he's on this trip, he's a vegetarian, and suddenly he sees that these people are catching cod, right? They're catching cod on the ship at the other end of the ship, and, you know, they're cutting them up and frying them up, and Ben Franklin formerly loved the Boston way of preparing cod, so it smells really good. So it's testing his vegetarian principles. And so he
was a vegetarian basically because he just believed that all life is sacred, or?
Yeah, it's some mixture of life is sacred, and they had some sort of vague notion of, like, health. And, remember, gout was a big problem sorts of things. So, you know, he smells this, but he's like, but I'm a vegetarian, right? So he, like, decides not to. And then, you know, he keeps smelling, it just smells so good. And eventually he decides to wander over just to see what they're up to, right? And so he sees them, and they're, like, catching all these cod, and they cut the cod open, and inside the cod, there are smaller fish. And he says to himself, these cod are murderers. Think of the millions of tiny fish that are being, you know, bullied and eaten by these larger cod. And what a service he would be doing to millions of fish by eating a few of these fish.
Yes.
Right? And so he says, you know, it is a convenient thing to be a reasonable creature because the mind can convince itself of whatever it feels like doing.
Yes.
Right?
That's great.
I'm
going to steal that story. That's great.
Right. It's a great, but this is exactly the point. This is how ideas move.
Yes.
You tell.
Well, you said to me too, that when people used to think that disease was caused by bad smells.
Mm-hmm.
So malaria is mal air.
Yeah.
Mal from the French bad, or maybe mm-hmm. it's Latin originally, but
Italian.
It's Italian. Mal air. So bad air.
Mm-hmm.
And people are bad, you said, at figuring out why things happen.
Yeah, we're actually individually, and this is one of the points that Haidt made in the podcast with Harris.
And Joseph Heinrich.
Yeah.
Heinrich.
So Haidt made the point that, like, humans individually are terrible at figuring out why things happen. But
the secret of our success is a good
example. But collectively, we can actually do a pretty good job. Because what happens is we talk things out. It's the same thing as what happens, you know, in a fight between a couple. Right? You fight, and the fighting is all basically a waste of time. Mm. Nothing is particularly achieved, right? And then there's a moment when the fight breaks, and then you start talking, and you start taking each other's perspective and trying to understand that. And as you do that, it's through that social intelligence of talking back and forth, you start to resolve your differences, and you create a view that is better than one that either of you had, right, before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you think about, like, when marriages work, right, you think of these old, wise couples. And it's because through all of those, that perspective taking, it's not the fighting, it's the perspective taking, they become wiser and wiser and wiser and wiser. And that's really what wisdom is. It's basically, you know, rounding out your mind through having to see things through other people's eyes, right? And testing different perspectives. So that's what science does, right? That's the idea of science is that, yeah, we all disagree, we all have these different things, but in the end, the good results emerge. The problem is, right, that the model on which most scientists are basing that approach is they're basing it on the approach of people like Harris, not on the beliefs of people like Haidt. So they have a rationalist model. So what they do is they're like, oh, the key is statistics, and it's, you know, papers with lots of jargon and all this sort of stuff. And then what ends up happening is you build up, like, there's now, I mean, if you go on something like PubMed, there's this huge thicket of papers, right? It's so many. But again, it's not good for actually moving those ideas.
Mm.
So what you have to do, and what, you know, David Sloan Wilson's issue is, the science to narrative chain, right?
Yeah.
So the point is that you go away, you understand the theory, and then you find good stories that you can tell to people, and it's the same thing as what Jesus did, but instead you're picking stories that demonstrate the principles, right? Where it's like it's an entertaining story, but contained within it is a lesson. And you think about the lesson, you think about the lesson, you think about the lesson, and you keep doing that, and over time you get better, right?
So science needs to be couched in humor.
Yeah,
art.
Huge amounts of it, as much as possible.
Yeah.
But in general, what tends to happen, right? One of the worst things that you can do in science is be anecdotal, right? I hate that. It's like,
well, what do you mean?
Well,
isn't anecdotal something that you, isn't that telling a story?
That's right. But so science has a paranoia internally about
evidence.
See.
So yes, science.
Right.
The empirical method, the scientific method.
That's right.
You've got to be able to repeat those results. You've got to have peer-reviewed results, which
that's
is good,
right.
of
which
course.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But the point is that there's two hats, right? Mm-hmm. So there's our science hat, and then there's our anecdotal hat. And someone like Ben Franklin understands that there are these two hats, and he switches his hats, right? It's theory versus practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that that's not the culture of science. So there's what the scientific principle is, which is perfect, just as the golden rule, right, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself is perfect.
Yeah.
But the actual culture of, you know, Catholicism or whatever does not reflect that.
Right.
So the scientific principle is perfect, but then the culture of science is distorted. And the distortion within the culture of science has been known for hundreds of years, right? And Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels famously parodied it. And, you know, again, here's a story that will tell you the lesson, right?
Mm.
So Gulliver's travel is he travels through all these different lands,
right.
But each of them is talking about a different form of human pride or arrogance.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's all a giant satire of human pride.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a great, great book. And wow. Actually, if you guys want to watch it, like HBO did a version like probably a decade ago or so with Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. It's amazing. It's really, really worth a watch. Yeah. It's very good.
Okay.
I haven't seen the Jack Black one, but...
Yeah. But in other words, you can watch... It's amazing how these stories, like Gulliver's Travels, just... They live on.
Because they're great. Because they're timeless.
Yeah.
But so one of the lands that that Gulliver goes to is the land of Laputa. Okay. And Laputa is this magical flying island that is levitated by a giant magnet in its middle. Right. And all the aristocrats live on this magical flying island. And then below, they rule over this giant kingdom called with the Balnibarbi. And so the Laputans love. Math and music and theory and all this sort of stuff. And they're so interested in theory that they spend all of their time with one eye raised to the zenith, right? So they're always like a little bit cockeyed. And they have no interest in anything practical. So even though they have like this amazing theoretical of math, knowledge...
It feels a little bit like the Aristotelian... Socratic division.
That's right.
Like Socrates was all about the ultimate result is have some quiet contempt for your biology.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he could stand for hours in the cold with one piece of chalk because even when he died, he was like, "Why are you guys crying? This is just I'm in a meat cage."
That's right.
You know, my ultimate goal is to become just a mind floating in the ether.
Exactly.
And Aristotle was like, "Dude, that's fine, but you know, if you ever seen a woman give childbirth." You know, it really sucks, man.
Yeah.
And it's very real.
Yeah.
So can we have a little earth with our sky?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the Laputans are so bad at engaging with practicality that even though they have this amazing theoretical knowledge, none of their clothes fit, like they're all falling apart, you know, and they have to be constantly accompanied by a guy who carries a giant bladder filled with air. And when they have to do something that pay attention to something in the physical world right in front of them, the attendant will hit them on the head with the bladder and they'll like snap to for a second and deal with that, right?
Huh.
But meanwhile, the kingdom, and they believe that they should rule over the people below them because they have this amazing theoretical knowledge, right? And so, but meanwhile, the people below, the Balnibarbi, are starving to death, right? So, and anytime the Balnibarbi try and rebel, the Laputans crash their island down on them.
God.
And this is...
And it's called the Balnibarbi?
Yeah, the Laputan and the Balnibarbis, right? So these two kingdoms. Now, the point is that, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, right, just said that, you know, what we really need is a country that is ruled purely by, like, evidence, an evidence-based country.
And philosopher kings.
That's right. But we already know what that would look like because Jonathan Swift told us 300 years ago. And just to give you an idea of what the Laputans spend their time doing, so some of the things that the Laputans are working on up there are how to extract sunbeams from cucumbers, how to reverse engineer shit back into food, and how to soften marble so that it can be used as pillows. And these were all things that the Royal Academy at the time of the writing was actually doing.
God damn.
Right? So it's this brilliant satire. But, you know, the David Sloan Wilson story about the diffusion of innovations, you know, he sent me this, I looked through it in my email yesterday, 99-page document. And the 99-page document is all about how we need to figure out how to turn science into stories, right? So that we can, like, use all this theoretical knowledge to practical...
David Sloan Wilson sent you this?
Yeah, a 99-page document, which was published, by the way, in 2014.
Nobody's going to read that, though.
Nobody's going to read
the problem
it. I did.
Good man.
I read it.
You're amazing.
No.
Because all you had to do, David, was write that one sentence.
That's right.
He's brilliant, and
his head's
in the right place. So is his heart, but yeah.
But again, like...
Again, David Sloan Wilson is not the guy who's going to move this narrative along. We need him as the... It's almost like we need David to be the engineer to create the incredible machine, and then we need salesmen.
Yeah, exactly.
We need salesmen who are, you know, who have a lot of high social intelligence and spend a lot of time making social networks.
But in essence, you know, I mean, I've also been thinking about this. Like, we're the engineers, you and me.
Yes.
Because the thing is, right, if you, there's a big...
We're the engineers? Well, you mean we're putting it together.
Well, you are. I'm trying. But that's why also I need you, right? Mm-hmm. So I sort of live in the world between the Laputans and the Balnibarbi.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Right? But yes. So, like, I'm not necessarily the most effective communicator, right?
You're pretty damn good, but I know you're...
Well, but I can act as a middleman, but...
Yeah, your brain is so fast and that Well, I don't know. I think you're an excellent communicator. I can't agree with you there, but
okay.
I'm with you that you're okay. That I'll give you that you're you have so much information that yes, you're okay. I'll give you. I'll put you in the middle. You're the middleman.
Middleman,
okay. And I'm
right.
the guy down the guy.
Yeah, but so
I'm in the muck.
But that's good. That's
yes.
where we need people.
Yes,
because
yes.
The point is that all of these ideas do have real practical relevance, and the reality is that the Bal and the Barbie are starving.
Mm.
Right, like there are problems in the world, and this again, as we've always talked about, all the answers are trapped in books.
Yes,
like you know, and just because in case it sounds like I'm unfairly categorizing science, mm. right? Let me tell you about some of my experiences within science, right? Right? So I worked at Cold Spring Harbor for a year, which was the lab that was set up by, it had existed, but the person who really developed it was Jim Watson of Watson and Crick, who discovered the double helical structure of DNA, right?
Yeah.
And while I was there, my first
I like
day,
that you said the double helical structure, because I always say the double helix. Don't really know what that means, but I like to use it.
Well, it's just, it's two
it's
intertwining.
Two spirals, yes.
Yeah, it's
yes,
a staircase. It's yes. two staircases.
Okay, actually, before we go on to that,
yeah.
can you just quickly explain how that even comes to be? It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, so what do those spirals represent? Do they represent a structure within our cells?
Well, so we could, this is a good story, right? So,
yeah.
So you have to understand that. So when Darwin writes, you know, On the Origin of Species, right, they don't know anything about DNA. Right? They don't even know, they don't really know very much about how information is transmitted from generation to generation. So all he talks about is a hereditary principle. He's like, there's clearly something, like baby horses look like, you know, adult horses, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids look like their parents. Like something is being passed on. What is that thing? And they had a lot of different theories and, you know, there were earlier versions of this, but essentially, yes, Darwin figured out that there was something that was being passed on. And then, by the way, that idea fell out of favor, right, which is not usually talked about. There's a great book called, I think it's the, I can't remember the title. It's like The Incredible Mr. Darwin or something like that. I can find out the exact title. I'll put it in the write-up. But it's basically, you know, Darwin's journey to figure out all of this. And, you know, people generally don't read the history of science because they're like, why do I need to know dead scientific theories, right? Mm-hmm. But what it does is it shows that even these incredible things are actually a process, and it sort of humanizes it and normalizes it, right? And you start to realize, like, oh, wow, this person worked on this for a long time, and they did all sorts of weird things. Like, Darwin worked on barnacles for 8 years before he published, right?
Right.
8 years on barnacles.
8 years.
Right?
God damn.
But so, you know, he didn't know what the hereditary principle was. And then they started to figure out what there was a lot of contenders for what that might be. They thought it might be proteins and they thought it might be DNA, right? And then there were a series of experiments that figured out that, oh, probably the hereditary principle was DNA, right? But what Jim Watson did, right, because Jim Watson, this is sort of Jim Watson's psychological bias. Jim Watson always had a nose for the sensational. And so he knew that whoever figured out the double helical structure of DNA was going to be a big deal. And so while other people were sort of, so Francis Crick was, you know, very smart, sort of puttering around, he had lots of projects he was working on. And Jim was the one who had the laser relentless focus on, we have to figure out this structure. And you can read his book, The Double Helix, which is, again, a great history of science book. But, you know, there's always been this sort of very conflicted history about Rosalind Franklin. So Rosalind Franklin was an X-ray crystallographer. So what that meant was she made crystals of pure proteins or pure DNA, and then you pass X-rays through them, and based on how those diffract, on how those X-rays are spread out, you can figure out what the structure was.
Wow.
Okay.
How the hell did they even know to isolate quote-unquote DNA?
Well,
how do you even know what DNA is?
Well, but that's the point.
Is that because it kept showing up in every cell?
Well, yeah, it's kept on showing up, but there was all sorts of other weird stuff, and that's the point. They weren't sure whether the hereditary material was proteins. They were just like, there's all this crap in there,
yeah.
right? Like, some of this crap must be the hereditary stuff. What is it?
Right.
Right? And so, you know, they sort of had to sort through that whole grab bag of stuff and start to see how does that work and, you know, what is it that's being passed
on. You look
is,
for consistencies.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there are crucial experiments like Hershey-Chase, right, was a big one. Barbara Hershey and then I can't remember Chase's first name. But, you know, there were these landmark experiments that basically pushed towards the conclusion, oh, crap, it's DNA.
It was a group effort.
A huge group effort, yeah. right? But Jim understood the symbolic significance of the structure. right? Okay. So he knew that even though it's a group effort, yeah. right? Like people don't talk about Hershey Chase, right? They talk no. about
Watson
Crick, yeah. right? So he knew that this was like the marketing thing to focus on. So Rosalind Franklin, right, who did all these X-ray crystallographs, and she was, you know, I mean, this is like...
A woman scientist,
and also, by the way...
Viva like, the feminist movement, go on.
Well, wait till you hear how the story progresses.
It's such a shame the women's movement is dead. Keep going.
But you know, this is getting good data, mm. right, is incredibly complex. Like, you imagine trying to create a crystal of pure DNA. Not easy, no. right? And then, like,
yeah,
lining
it's hard
it up.
For me to do. I do it in my garage.
Well, but that's you, Brian.
Yeah.
You
know, well, no, it's crystal meth. Never mind. Keep going.
Breaking Bad?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just inspired by the show.
Well, keep it going. Is. It is.
Yeah.
But so, anyway, so Rosalind Franklin has these amazing X-ray crystallographs, right? And these pictures are going to help you figure out what the structure was. And it's never been clear, but there's a lot of people believe that Jim stole those pictures.
Damn.
Right?
Son of a bitch.
Okay. So then...
Damn.
So he steals those pictures, probably, right? But again, this is like, you know, what happened. Not everybody's totally sure. And on the basis of these pictures and a bunch of other people, so there's a guy called Chargaff, right? And Chargaff had this data, and what Chargaff had figured out is that whatever animal you look at, right, the ratio of adenine to thymine is always the same, and the ratio of guanine to cytosine is always the same, right? So there's like this pattern that somehow A seems to go with T and G seems to go with C, right? Mm-hmm. So they have all these different pieces, and then they literally, like, were building models in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, trying to figure out, okay, so we've got, there's this A goes with T and G goes with C, we've got Rosalind Franklin's X-ray crystallographs, right, and lots of other pieces, and what structure satisfies all this? And ultimately, they figure out that it's a double helix. But the crucial thing is that, and it's one of the greatest papers in science, it's like 2 pages, right? I mean, this is like great scientific writing. And there's a famous line in there where they basically say, it hasn't escaped our notice that this proposes that this structure suggests a model for replication. And the reason why is because basically DNA works like a zipper. And you can unzip one half, right, and then make an exact copy on the other half. Right, and then make an exact copy on the other half. Right, so the point is that because to talk it through more. Right, so right, you unzip the zipper, and there are 2 fitting halves. Right, so let's imagine that you have a DNA sequence that is adenine thymine. Right, well, the match would be thymine adenine. Right, because T always goes with A, and A always goes with T. Right.
Okay.
Right. So you can do that for all 4.5 billion base pairs.
I think it's funny that I zoned out.
Yeah.
When you said adenine and thymine, which is relevant because when you start using words I don't know, and we all do this, I go, "Ooh, this sounds complicated. I'm panicking," and I zone out. I go somewhere else. The minute you did that, I'm sorry to do this, but the minute you did that, I started thinking about. I don't know why, but water skiing on one ski.
No, but that's great. But yeah.
This is the problem when we get technical like this. This is the problem with getting ideas. You're trying to explain in layman's terms,
yeah,
and very well, by the way, sort of how the double helix came about,
yeah.
And when you say Watson may have stolen from Roslyn, yeah. I go, hey,
yeah.
I'm intrigued because it's a story that I understand.
100%.
Right?
But that's the whole point.
Because there's a bad guy and there's a good guy.
That's right. But that's exactly like the science to narrative chain, right?
Right.
And like, it's the reason why you need, like, why this actually takes work is because turning this stuff into good stories.
Yeah.
You have to
I don't
really
know how to turn thymine and adenine
into a good story.
Into a good story.
Yeah.
But.
Well, let's think about it this
go
way.
Go back
no,
again.
No, let's think of it this way, right? So there's a couple, right? So there's friends, right? So adenine and thymine are friends.
Yeah.
And they always hang out together, right? And, you know, guanine and cytosine are also friends.
Guanine and cytosine are inseparable. Always.
Yeah. Always friends.
Always fucking. Like that couple from Dante's Inferno.
They fuck all the time.
All the time.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the point is that when you have a G and a C, right? Whenever you have a G.
Is this a swinger story? Because I get excited.
It is a swinger story.
All right, good.
Right? So actually, I had a friend in college, right, who is gay and out of the closet now.
How dare he?
But he grew up in Louisiana.
Oh, Jesus.
And at some point.
That's actually physically dangerous.
Yeah. But so at some point, his science teacher says to him, like, this is part of science class, right? And he's like, this is a plug and this is a socket. You see how they go together.
Oh,
if I take a plug and a plug, they don't go together.
Yeah, that plug doesn't have an asshole in a mouth. So you're wrong.
But so it's, you know, it is like a plug and a socket,
dumbass.
Right?
Yeah.
So A and T always go together, plug and socket, and then G and C always go together, plug and socket.
Okay.
Okay. So the point is that if you have, like, you can, and this is the sort of thing they make you do in high school biology class, you write out a whole long sequence, right? And it's like A, T, G, C, 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 T, 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 A, right? And just by knowing that A and T are friends and G and C are friends, you can then write the other strand.
Okay.
Right? You can write out exactly what that would be.
Because you know what the order is. They always go together.
They always go together.
Yeah.
So what happens is that when you're replicating DNA, you unzip those two strands, and on each side, you can make an exact copy on each side.
Okay.
Right? So you can basically, it would be like you undo your zipper, and then instantly, the other side of the zipper fills in. Right? So now I have two zippers.
Okay.
Right? And that is the basis of how life copies itself.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay.
But
so in other words, when you so what does that have to do with thymine and adenine though? You're basically taking the plug out of the socket.
Well,
right?
so when you unzip,
right?
So when you talk about, right, so you know each human cell has about 4.5 billion base pairs, right?
Jesus Christ.
And base pair is just an adenine or a thymine or a guanine or a cytosine.
Okay.
So it's this long 4.5 billion letter sentence.
Jesus.
That is basically like A T G C C C C C T T T T A, like binary code,
yeah.
Ones and zeros,
yeah.
Right? And so all of that, then what happens is that each of those certain, so then, you know, and this was like Francis Crick's work later, after they figured out the double helix, they then went and figured out, okay, so each of those three-letter codes, then when you have three of them, so like if you have TAG or something like that, well, that will code for an amino acid, right?
Okay.
And an amino acid is one of the parts of a protein. So
yeah.
As a person of incredible musculature,
thank you.
You
need a lot of protein.
Right. But you have to take, there are certain like essential amino acids, right?
Yes.
Like lysine. And these are ones that your body can't produce naturally, right? So there are about 20 amino acids,
mm-hmm.
right? So the what's called the central dogma of biology, right, which your dad referenced once in an email, is the fact that there's DNA, right? And then DNA is turned into a middleman.
RNA.
And then RNA is turned into proteins.
Oh, I didn't know.
Right?
Okay.
So essentially so let's say that you have someone like, for example, you have a condition like cystic fibrosis.
Right.
So cystic fibrosis, something goes wrong with the DNA, right, which can just be as little as like one letter changing, which then changes one amino acid, which then means that the protein that is supposed to carry chloride ions in your lungs doesn't work.
God damn.
Right? So
It's those tiny details.
Yeah. So these little mistakes happen.
And when you start breaking it down like that, it's almost like, yeah, food and environment make a difference, and maybe they do have an effect, but it's funny to see how science now is, when you get into the minutiae and you learn more and more about the way a cell works,
mm-hmm.
or how to manipulate that
mm-hmm.
cell or that gene or that protein or that molecule.
Right.
It's almost like it almost renders all the other shit obsolete. But not really.
Well, because the problem is, so...
Well, because then you have weird shit. Like, well, how come people who are happy and come from strong communities live longer?
Well, but
maybe that's just as important for keeping the molecule together.
Huge, well, it doesn't affect necessarily the molecule, right? But so now we can talk about... So now you've seen the sort of the basic idea of evolution,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that you have blind copying, right? So from generation to generation, the DNA is blindly copied.
Yeah.
But occasionally there are mistakes.
Yeah.
And these mistakes
Mutations are
good.
Yeah.
Most of the time they're bad.
Yeah, right? Sometimes they're good.
Sometimes they're good, right? So the point is that this is the exact same way that culture works.
Well, things can mutate based on environmental pressure, too.
Exactly.
Right?
And
yeah.
so this is
so
why
if I'm a nomad and I have to cross the desert, it would behoove me not to lose my lactose gene, my ability to convert milk into good nutrition,
mm-hmm.
because I need that water when I'm crossing the desert.
Well, and the energy source of lactose, which is a sugar.
Yeah.
Right? So But in the same way, so the basic idea, right, and again, we're dealing with, and this is something that scientists generally freak out about. You have to understand that, you know, just as, like, we're all emotional about certain things, mm-hmm. there are certain words that you mention, like, you know...
Anine and glutamine. And
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There are things that scientists are emotional about. They're emotional about anecdotes, even though that paranoia doesn't serve science, mm-hmm. right? They're emotional and paranoid about simplification, mm-hmm. even though that fear of simplification doesn't serve the communication of science, right? And so, you know, so we're going to engage in simplification because we actually care about having these ideas put into practice.
Yeah.
But so the basic idea of cultural evolution, you have the same idea, right? There's blind copying from generation to generation, but occasionally there's a mistake. Mm. Right? And sometimes those mistakes are good. And also, it doesn't have to be just mistakes, because what happens is that mindsets change in response to the pressures of environment.
Okay.
Right? So we're going to talk about one specific example of that today. And that is, we all know that sort of culture has beliefs, values, and perspectives, right? But these are often very vague terms. So we're going to, in the next few episodes, we're going to work through some concrete examples. So let's start off with a concrete example, perspectives. So everybody has optimism and pessimism. We all know that we have these two mindsets, but we use them in very different ratios, right? Some people massively overfavor pessimism. Some people massively overfavor optimism. Now, what's your feeling about optimism and pessimism? Do you think one's better than the other?
Well, I think you need both. I mean, when pessimism, I don't think pessimism is necessarily something that's, well, critical thinking can be confused with pessimism.
Right.
But blind positivity.
Right.
Is also naive.
Mm-hmm.
And can lead an innocent into the maw, the jaws of death, you know?
Right.
So you need to temper pessimism and optimism. I like a pessimistic comedian.
Right.
You know, there's something about a nihilist or a pessimist that can be very funny, mm-hmm. if you marry it with humor,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that, well, I'm here anyway, so I may as well make lemonade out of lemons.
Right. So to take that, what I'm getting from that, and your model is actually quite good.
I'm trying not to be a reductionist, in other words.
Well, but your model is good, right? Mm. So a lot of people tend to think, you know, optimism good, pessimism bad, yes. in America, right?
Yes.
In Russia, they often think optimism delusional.
It's for dummies.
Yeah, exactly.
Smiling all the time. You're a dummy.
Yeah. And then pessimism is realistic.
Yes.
This is how the world works.
That's why they
right?
don't smile.
That's why they don't smile.
Literally in Russia, if you smile, you're considered a fucking
retard.
Like, why is this guy smiling generally? I mean, really.
Right. So, but your model, right, and we can sharpen it up even more, but your model is the most realistic one, right? Which is that optimism and pessimism are complementary,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it works like yin and yang.
Mm-hmm.
And the key is knowing when to use each one. Now, the first thing to realize is the fact that hunter-gatherers use them well without even trying,
mm-hmm.
right? So in a state of nature, before we started to get complex societies, you know, we didn't have a real problem with, like, overusing one or the other. So if you remember Jared Diamond's book, The World Until Yesterday,
mm-hmm.
he talks about this very interesting phenomenon, constructive paranoia, where, you know, the people, when they're in their village, these Papua New Guinean cannibals, right, they're all, like, fairly happy and all that stuff. But once they go out into the forest, they become massively paranoid,
mm-hmm.
right? Suddenly they're worried that every tree is rotten and going to fall on them. They're constantly worried about stepping in a hole and twisting their ankle. They're always watching for snakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is an appropriate use of that paranoia, because
mm-hmm.
what it does is it prevents you from injuring yourself in an environment where medical care is non-existent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and
where
even
a blister can kill.
Exactly. And yeah. people, when you talk about, like, you know, what you know, very often, like, into the wild or any of those sorts of things, you have these people who don't have a proper respect for nature, right? And so they just sort of blithely wander in. Or Grizzly Man, which is one of the greatest
Jesus
documentaries
Christ.
Ever made.
That dumb.
Right.
Applying. talk about stamping anthropomorphic qualities on a 1,000-pound dog.
But my favorite is there's that clip in Grizzly Man where he's, like, talking to the camera, and all of a sudden you see this, like, lean, hungry, angry bear coming up behind him, and he turns around and slaps the bear across the muzzle.
He's
right?
He's amazing.
And then he says, and he has, like, he's like, you're a bad bear, Mr. Grinch, or Grinch, or whatever.
No, get away.
Yeah, and he calls the bear the Grinch. So he's like, this bear has a bad temperament, right? Yeah. And he's slapping it.
Yeah.
And they're pretty sure that's the bear that ate him.
Really?
Yeah.
Good fucking God. God, that's terrifying. The thing was stalking you, dummy. Yeah. Your food. Your food, and he's hungry.
But so, you know, a
cried over a bee being dead. He was a genius.
Anyway. But the point is that you're not going to see a Papua New Guinean like wandering around and slapping bears, right?
Well, even, I mean, a lot of the Inuit who were there were like, look, this guy was violating principles that we've been living by for thousands of years.
Right. Right. So the point is the Inuit have evolved a culture that serves that environment, right? And it's smart. So the point is that we used to not have psychologists. We used to not have shrinks to try and get us to deal with our optimism and pessimism. We used to do it fairly naturally.
Well, right? Yeah, I guess it was imposed on us, wasn't it?
Well, so what?
By the environment, I mean.
Well, but agriculture pretty much screws everything up, right? It screws up our entire culture, right? So we had Richard Nisbet on and, you know, atomistic and holistic thinking, right? The West massively overfavors atomistic thinking. The East massively overfavors holistic thinking.
So atomistic thinking meaning individual, like I'm the individual.
Yeah, and you break everything up into tiny little pieces.
Yeah, reductionists, right. You know. It's we do that with our food, right? So the study will come out and say omega-3 fatty acids or whatever they are good for you.
Right.
In fish or whatever. And so people that eat fish tend to have this, that, and the other thing. Have less chance of Alzheimer's. Well, now the food industry comes along and now you're buying pills to take lots of different kinds of fish oils.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's put it in bread. Let's put it in everything.
Exactly. But so the Western mind is atomistic and it goes nuts and it splits apart things that shouldn't be split up, right? So, you know, to connect back to the intuitionist versus rationalist thing, what this all really goes back to is the fact that you know, hundreds of years ago, Descartes, right, split up two things that were actually one thing.
The mind and emotion?
Well, thinking and feeling, right? And so they're actually one thing, right? And there's a great book by Antonio Damasio that most people haven't read called Descartes' Error, where he tells the story
of...
Yeah, where he tells the story of how he figured out that thinking and feeling are actually one thing. But you don't, and it's a good book, and you can read it, but, you know, we already sort of know this for some emotions. Mm-hmm. We understand that the feeling of fear comes with a certain type of thinking, right?
Okay.
But we don't connect, we don't realize
I think that, we also know that anxiety can lead to bad health, to bad physical
totally,
health, you know.
Totally, totally. Yeah. But we don't necessarily understand that every single emotion, right, that emotion is always there. Right, there's always a feeling that is driving a certain kind of thinking and a certain kind of behavior.
Yes.
Right? So shame drives a certain kind of behavior,
yes.
Right? You hide the object of your shame, right? And that's a big one in
well, even that guy who was describing the, you know, sort of the state of nature with a plug and a socket.
Right.
That teacher was being very rational, but he wasn't. He wasn't seeing the whole picture, obviously.
Well, he's trying to deal with something rationally, and he thinks that this is what he's doing is he's rationalizing his behavior.
That's right.
It's the same thing. It goes back to Ben Franklin, right?
Well, what makes sense, dude? You've never seen a fat vegetable.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Eat vegetables, you'll never get fat. You know,
right.
Those kinds of things where you're like, huh?
But the real issue is the intuition.
Yeah.
Like, we can spend all our time with that teacher who's talking about the plug and socket, like, arguing over whether, you know, homosexuality is okay or not. But what we have to do is we have to change the feeling, right? And until we change the intuition, what Hike talks about is the big elephant, right, that drives most of our choices, nothing changes, right? We could try and rationally argue with a Russian that, like, pessimism is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? But it's not going to change anything, right?
No.
You have to cut through and you have to change that feeling.
Well,
right?
It's a little bit like when I was talking to Darren Acemoglu about Why Nations Fail.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such an amazing book, and it makes you very sad for the world because unless a country has institutions with true integrity, objective, you know, sovereign, their own sovereignty almost.
Right.
Right. So courts that matter, courts that actually can impose things, rule of law, not rule by man, rule by law, not rule by influence, et cetera, et cetera. Unless you have that, you don't have a strong country.
Right.
You're never going to advance and have the goodies that, say, countries like Britain, Germany, and the United States do.
100%.
Because with that goes liberal democracy and the fact that you can benefit from and have certain measures to go, certain measures that protect your private property. You have an infrastructure that will hold those that break promises to you accountable, et cetera, et cetera. And when I said to Darren Acemoglu, I said, I wish Putin would read this book. That's not going to change Putin's mind. What it might do, though, is it didn't change any of the Chinese Politburo's mind either. But the people three levels down read it and loved it.
Right.
So maybe because you're young and naive and still trying to figure the world out, that's when you want to get, that's when you want to tap into people's notion of possibility, which, by the way, is imagination, which, by the way, is fueled by emotion.
Yeah. And, but also it's important to realize that, you know, it's, there's, you know, your dad, my dad, right? They sort of come out of the era of Henry Kissinger. Right. And the idea is if you can build good institutions, then you change a society. Right. Mm-hmm. But institutions are only a part of culture. Right.
Yeah.
There's also
institutions can also be very exclusionary.
Yeah.
See, ask a black person.
But well, what you have to do is you have to create a culture that supports the institutions. Mm-hmm. Right. So the point is that it doesn't matter that we know what institutions should look like. After this, after the Russian Revolution, they changed the institutions to democracy. Right. But the nature of Russian culture is such that they like a strong man.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so inevitably, even though they now have elections and voting and all that sort of stuff, it devolves back to what the culture wants.
Mm.
And until you change that culture, you're fundamentally not going to get anything different.
Yeah. You're not going to be driving Russian cars, using Russian computers.
That's right.
Wearing Russian clothes.
100%.
They'll remain a one crop economy.
Right. Which is oil.
Yeah. And I suppose some weaponry.
Yeah. But so let's talk about optimism and pessimism.
Yeah.
So you've nailed what the differences are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Optimists are much more productive, they're much more happy, they're all these sorts of things. But they're delusional. That's the blind spot. Pessimists see all the problems. So what you find is that there's, you know, Martin Seligman has written a lot about this stuff, right? And he has a book called Learned Optimism and a bunch and Authentic Happiness and all this stuff. But one of the things in there is that they've done studies of what mindset does better in what professions. And in almost every single profession, optimists do better.
Mm.
But pessimists do better in a very particular profession. See if you can guess what it is.
I would imagine law.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Right? So, and it's because, why is that?
Well, you've got to assume that people are, you've got to assume that the other side is trying to fuck you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah.
So the point is that it's paranoia, mm-hmm. right? And that paranoia means that, you know, your legal contract has every single loophole is being closed, right? You've thought of everything that can go wrong and all that sort of stuff. The toll, though, of pessimism, right, that much pessimism, is massive alcoholism, right, and other forms of substance abuse, failed marriages, especially for female lawyers.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
Which is, does that sound like any country we know?
The United States of America.
Well, the substance abuse is Russia.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right? And if you look, right, the Americans are famous for being optimists, right? But, you know, there's recently been this huge outbreak in middle America of, like, opioid problems, right? People using...
Yeah, and white people are dying earlier than their parents were, apparently.
That's right.
The life expectancy is falling.
And that's what happens when people lose faith in the American dream.
Hmm.
Losing faith in the American dream, not having a society that actually makes that a realistic possibility.
Well, the idea that I have the potential to get out of this shit.
That's right. That people die.
Yeah.
So, you know, pessimism kills, but the point is...
And out of Africa, I think that Isaac Dennison talks about the Maasai. Maybe it's just in the movie. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've seen or read both. But there's this sort of legend when you capture a Maasai warrior and you put him behind bars, he dies.
Yeah.
Regardless if you feed or clothe him, because you've taken away his future, his freedom.
That's right.
The ability to look out at something.
Right.
It's kind of interesting.
Well, and you know, I mean, Man's Search for Meaning, right? Viktor mm-hmm. Frankl, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah.
And he basically just talks about that, you know, the people who had some sort of purpose or something to aim for who were in the Holocaust survived.
Well, even, and what was revolutionary about that book to me is the idea that, you know, even suffering with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
It, when it's impossible to do so, that's
right.
A huge accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
Suffer well.
Yeah.
Die well.
And Jesus. We all know, I mean, like my grandmother, God. Right on my dad's side, when her, you know, after my grandfather died, like, that was a lot of the purpose in her life was gone. Mm. And she stopped doing lots and lots of little things to take care of her health, right? Yeah. Exercising, you know, going for her walks, eating well, all that sort of stuff. She just sort of, the will to live was lost. Mm. And then, you know, she starts to degenerate, and the more she degenerates, right, the less will to live she has, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, people need purpose, and mm-hmm. that's the problem is that, in, you know, again, like, you know, throughout history, we've seen sort of, you know, nice fantasies that weren't actual practicalities, and that's sort of the problem. Like, hope is great, Obama, but, like, you need a realistic plan. And if you don't have a realistic plan, then people end up dying.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, to talk turkey, right, you know, in general, you know, there are three groups that have sort of wrapped themselves in the flag of science, and that's liberals, atheists, and
and conservatives, right? I mean, not really.
Well, not really.
A lot of them don't believe in evolution.
Right. But yeah. You know, someone like, if you ask, you have Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he promises his country rationalia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you asked Obama, would you say, is your policy driven by science? And he would say yes. And the problem is, no, they're not.
Yeah.
Right? You may have read some science, but your thinking is full of magical thinking.
Hmm.
Because fundamentally, these ideas haven't diffused within science. They haven't diffused within universities. All the science we're talking about here, I did not learn at Eton, probably the most expensive private school in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not learn it at Harvard, probably the most expensive university in the world. I learned it by reading books.
Right. Well, that is a good place to wrap this up.
Yeah.
That's a good place too. That's a good way to, look at this. I set my timer too. That's an excellent, sort of button for this, because you can educate yourself
entirely with reading books. And do you remember Good Will Hunting?
Yes.
Right. So one of my favorite lines is when, you know, Will goes up to the Harvard dickhead in the bar,
yep.
right? And he says, you're going to realize, you know, when, you know, in 20 years or whatever, you're going to realize two things. One, don't do that, because he used his intellect to belittle Chucky,
yep.
right? And then he said, and two, that you spent $40,000 on an education that you could have gotten for $2.50 in late library fees. And it's 100%
it's so true. It's so true. What was that quote to leave that someone said? Was it Thomas Jefferson about reading books? The founding fathers.
Well, they read voraciously. I mean, David McCulloch, right,
yeah.
who wrote 1776,
yes.
and he won the Pulitzer Prize for it, and it's a great, great book. But he has a great line in there where he says, they lived in a time when it was believed that a man, by serious and diligent application to books, could teach himself whatever was required.
There you go. Hunter Motz, class is over, ladies and gentlemen. A little mixed martial arts for the mind.
Let's bow out.
A little mixed martial mental artists. I bow to you. Cyberly.
I bow to you.
I bow to you, and I bow to you. Hunter's wearing a beautiful polo, a yellow polo shirt with khakis.
Fake yellow polo.
You couldn't be more Dutch and white.
No, this is fake, though. This is a knockoff.
You elitist. You probably support the police.
No, I bought this in Cambodia.
Oh.
My father haggled it down.
That's great. For $5. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. We love you.
Love you guys.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.